I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon. A Pew Charitable Trust recently reported that states that have cut their imprisonment rates, along with some other reforms, have experienced a greater crime drop than those that increased incarceration. Between 2007 and 2012, the 10 states with the largest decreases in imprisonment rates had a 12% average reduction in crime. The 10 states with the largest imprisonment rate increases saw crime fall to 10%. This hour of the program, we're going to be looking at whether or not prison is the best answer for many offenders. Actually, it is part of the answer that Right on Crime said prison may not be the best alternative. And it's a national movement of conservatives who support a criminal justice system reflecting fiscal discipline, a belief in redemption, the empowerment of victims, and a reliance on solid evidence to determine the most effective use of taxpayer funds to reduce recidivism and also to improve public safety. This hour, we are going to be speaking with a gentleman from Texas. It was a Texas attorney who became one of the nation's leading advocates of conservative criminal justice reform. Vikrant Reddy will join us momentarily. He's policy analyst in the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Policy Foundation, where he coordinates the Right on Crime campaign. And later in the hour, we will be speaking with the Reverend Willie Briscoe, who is from Milwaukee, and will have a Wisconsin focus the second half hour. He's president of MICA here in Milwaukee and had a 25-year distinguished career in law enforcement and corrections. He retired as Deputy Superintendent of the Milwaukee County House of Corrections, and they are calling for reform now, looking at the parole system in the state of Wisconsin and how many people may be behind bars and shouldn't be. All hour long, this is a topic that I'm sure many of you will want to call in and express your opinions on. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Vikrant Reddy, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me on today.
Yeah, our pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us. So it was a Texas attorney, I have read, who became one of the nation's leading advocates of conservative criminal justice reform. What happened in Texas that wasn't going very well when it came to prisons?
Well, what happened was that we were just building more and more and more prisons, and we weren't necessarily getting the best possible results in terms of public safety. Now, it goes without saying that you will get results. I mean, if you have a room of 100 people and you incarcerate 90 of them, crime is most likely going to go down. But that's not the most sensible way to go about doing it. You cast your net so broadly at a certain point that you start catching lots of nonviolent, low-level offenders, people who aren't necessarily helped by going into prison. And actually, what then further happens is that you find a lot of these people who are, again, low-level, nonviolent offenders, they spend time next to really bad, hardened criminals who need to be in prison, and then those nonviolent offenders come out even worse than they started. And this is what we were doing in Texas as we built and built, and governors from both parties, by the way, went on an absolute prison-building spree, mm-hmm. Governor Bush, Governor Richards, Governor Clements. It really became a bipartisan thing at a certain point. We just built prisons.
So Texas and other states as well have looked at other options. Is it correct to say that you've done drug courts, you've looked at some rehabilitation programs for addicts and for people who may be mentally ill?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. We finally hit kind of a breaking point in 2007 when our legislature was told by an agency that does some internal budget crunching that we would need an extra 17,000 prison beds by the year 2012 and that it would cost $2 billion.
Ooh.
And it's quite a lot of money, and the legislators, particularly in Texas, said, you know, we just are not interested in raising taxes. We're not interested in dipping into surplus funds. It's just not part of the political culture of the state. Is there any way that we can do this without spending $2 billion? And the answer was that, well, you could start looking at the kinds of programs you just mentioned, better drug treatment, better mental health treatment, and hope that if you solve the problem on the prevention end and on the front end, you have people spending less time behind bars and you end up spending less money. That's, in fact, exactly what happened.
So I must ask, why didn't we follow that philosophy a long time ago before we spent so much money and built so many prisons?
Well, I think it was very difficult a few decades back. We'll both remember that there was a period where there was really an awful crime epidemic in the United States, particularly in urban areas. It was awful. New York City became notorious. I can tell you just as a personal anecdote, my grandfather was mugged 5 times in New York.
Ooh.
He lived in Staten Island, not in Manhattan. I mean, it just was really, really awful. And so you saw these stories running on the news every single night. It really, there was a period there where it just dominated American politics.
Mm-hmm.
The 1988 presidential election was dominated by the Willie Horton ad, which George H.W. Bush ran against Michael Dukakis. And actually, a lot of people don't realize in the Democratic primary, Al Gore originally brought up against Michael Dukakis. It was a way to tag people as soft on crime and to kind of prey on the fears that a lot of Americans justifiably had of a very serious crime epidemic. But again, as I said at the beginning of the interview, you can focus on incarcerating more and getting stronger on the crime issue, but at a certain point, you start casting your net too widely, and you start catching lots and lots of people who you didn't need to catch in the first place, and it becomes counterproductive. The pendulum swings too far to the other side.
There are some terms, and I'm not sure if they're part of an old system or still in much of the prison system right now. People will be familiar with the terms mandatory minimums, 3 strikes, you're out. Are those policies gone now, or do some states still incorporate them?
It's interesting. There are places where they are still very much active. There are places where they're used far less. Excuse me. In fact, here's a really fascinating comparison. We'll talk about my state of Texas versus California. People are probably very familiar with the fact that California has one of the most notorious mandatory minimum laws in the country. It is called 3 strikes, you're out. It was passed in the mid-90s. It garnered a lot of media attention when it was being considered. And the results of the 3 strikes, you're out law have, again, been very counterproductive in California. Just a few years ago, California's prison overcrowding became so serious and so acute that the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a federal order saying that this overcrowding situation violated the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution. It's cruel and unusual punishment. They were just going to have to start releasing people. And California's had some mixed results, as you might imagine, whenever you're told that you very quickly need to start letting a few people go. You don't have the ability to monitor carefully who it is you are and aren't realigning in your prison system. So that's the really terrible situation that California has had with mandatory minimums. Meanwhile, here in Texas, we largely did not implement mandatory minimum sentencing. So in 2007, when advocates came before the legislature and said, instead of locking these people up, let's focus on drug courts, let's focus on mental health treatment, they weren't hemmed in. They didn't say, well, we'd like to do that, but we're obligated by statute to impose mandatory sentences of this sort. They didn't have that problem. So they managed to pass these reforms, and you've seen Texas have terrific results. It has the lowest crime rate it's had since 1968.
And
those prisons that we were told, those 17,000 prison beds that we were told will have to be built, were not built. In fact, Texas has closed 3 prisons in just the last 3 years.
That's really a remarkable statistic that you just gave. Lowest crime rate since 1968.
Yes, and it's worth noting, I should say, that crime is declining all over the country. In fact, it's really declining all over the developed world, and it's a really fascinating question. There are social scientists working round the clock trying to answer the question of why crime has declined, and there are all kinds of theories surrounding this. But the one fundamental thing we know is that it's not entirely just because we increased incarceration. We know that because there are jurisdictions in the United States where they dramatically ramped up incarceration, and there are others where they did not ramp up incarceration. And in all of these places, crime fell. In fact, in many instances, as that Pew report details, in the places where they didn't incarcerate as much, it fell more. So it's quite wrong to say that just because you lock people up, you're going to have greater declines in crime. It doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm. The founder of Right on Crime talks about, and these figures are probably low at this point, 2014, 58 correctional facilities have closed across the nation. And he reminds us that around two-thirds of decommissioned beds were in states with Republican governors. Why is that?
Well, there are a few reasons for that. One of the main ones, I think, is the prominence of the prison guard unions in a number of blue states, states with a very strong liberal political culture. California, again, is a great example of that. Illinois is another terrific example of that. In these states, you have seen prison guard unions be incredibly resistant to reform ideas, as you might imagine they would be. In California, people frequently say that it's the most powerful labor union in the state. So you've had that problem. I think also on the right, in red states where you have Republican governors and Republican legislatures, there has been just a lot of concern among the rising Tea Party over the last few years about excess spending. That has become a very significant issue. And I also think, interestingly enough, the story that's not told nearly as much as it should be is that social conservatives have really latched onto this issue. There's a narrative of redemption and second chances and also a real sense that incarceration and what it does to fathers and in terms of locking them up in a lot of poor neighborhoods is just ravaging American families. There's a sense among social conservatives that that problem needs to be reckoned with. And I think in that sense, social conservatives in a lot of Republican-leaning states have been leading on the issue.
Mm-hmm. Vikram, what have you done with the prisons that have been closed? What happens to those facilities?
Well, it's always something a little bit different. I can tell you that here in Texas, part of the impetus for closing them is that the state has been growing so rapidly that there were areas where these prisons were located near Houston or close to downtown Dallas where the real estate just became incredibly valuable. And people started saying, why do we have prison facilities here? We have shopping malls. We could have all kinds of great things that would be great for economic development. It doesn't make any sense to have prisons. And so they're turning these facilities into things that can actually be used and enjoyed by the community.
Shopping malls, huh? They're turning them into shopping malls?
Well, I mean, shopping malls is sort of a glib example. But you know, things that actually provide some kind of an economic boom for the community.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have several of them. Several of you are online already. This hour of the program, we're talking about a conservative movement to try and re-examine why we put people in prison, who is in prison, and if indeed there might be a better way, particularly for nonviolent offenders, for those who may be mentally ill. States like Texas and other states with conservative Republican governors have latched on to this, and more than, as I just said, two-thirds of decommissioned beds were in states with Republican governors during the last few years. Is there a better way? Are we spending, I believe in Wisconsin, the numbers are that we spend much more on prisons, incarcerating people in this state than the whole university system in the state. Is there something that we should be doing differently? What do you think? We'll welcome your phone calls. I guess the first part of the show is Vikrant Reddy. He's a policy analyst with the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and he coordinates the Right on Crime campaign. In the state of Wisconsin, our guest to the second part of the show, Reverend Willie Briscoe, will talk about parole and parole being a problem that people are not being able to get parole, even though they're eligible for it in the state of Wisconsin, and some other issues. So that's coming up. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, our phone number for Vicarant Ready is 800-486-8655. Is there a better alternative than prison for certain kinds of offenders? Should we be closing some prisons? Should we have courts that look at drug courts, rehabilitation for those who are in for nonviolent drug-related offenses? Or are there some prisoners who are being held far too long? Do we need to look at families and reuniting families and believe in redemption? That's our thought. This our questions this hour. So feel free to respond. We start with Chris in the Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Chris.
Happy, beautiful day.
It is beautiful.
I have a horror story. I was arrested in Milwaukee on the basis of a bunch of parking tickets I couldn't afford to pay because I was unemployed and I was in the process of applying for disability. The Milwaukee Police Department pulled a 7-year-old bench warrant on me, even though I have absolutely no history of ever committing a violent crime or even a misdemeanor other than having parking tickets. And they sent 7 squad cars and a paddy wagon over to my house, surrounded the block. Well, they were making a spectacle of me in front of my neighbors so that everybody knew who was in charge, basically. They hauled me to, after 24 hours of sitting in detention where I could not be fed, and I had taken my medications with me, but I never, ever in the whole stint of this thing ever got a pill. And they disappeared off the face of the planet, interestingly enough. I got hauled to the Milwaukee City Jail. I spent 24 hours there in horrible pain, and then got hauled to the House of Corrections in Milwaukee, where the intake nurse decided I was too sick to be put in jail. And then I got taken to Frederick, where they poked me full of needles for 3 hours and decided the doctor there was so angry about what was going on that he wanted to put me in a $1,500 a day hospital bed until we sorted this out. And that he sent me back to the House of Corrections with the guarantee that they would take care of me, but they did not. They starved me for 10 days because I have terrible food allergies.
You're there 10 days for parking tickets? 10 days?
Oh, they gave me 90 days. Eventually, when I just stopped eating and I just slept all the time, and I refused to even go in to try and eat because I would start bleeding internally if they did this to me, because there wasn't anything there I could eat, and they basically said it was tough.
What was the outcome?
They ultimately let me go on a bracelet situation because they couldn't take care of me. But in the meantime, life completely fell apart. They came into my house and confiscated my dogs and took them to the Humane Society. And if I hadn't gotten out in the next couple of days, they would have put my dogs to sleep or adopted them out. It cost me $500 to get my dogs out. And then my life just completely deconstructed because of this whole situation. I ended up, you know, wonderfully enough, my experience in the courts has been that once in a while you do get in front of a compassionate judge. I ended up in front of Judge Lewis Butler Jr., who now teaches at the university's line for the federal judgeship, and they should give him that judgeship. He took a look at me and said, "You were in jail for parking tickets, and you got these parking tickets where?" I said, "Mostly at work downtown." He said he took a red marking pen and he drew a no trespassing sign through my paperwork and said, "Get the hell out of my courtroom." He was really angry, and he just took out all of my fines. Everything was gone, and I had a clean slate to work with.
But what year was this? When was this, Chris?
It was in Milwaukee.
No, what year?
Oh, gosh. Probably 94, 95, someplace in there.
How do you respond to this, Vicarant? Kind of a dramatic story. I don't know if this kind of thing happens frequently. Maybe it does. I don't know.
Well, I think I just have one very simple thing to say, which is that if they want him to pay his parking tickets, he's sure as heck not going to do it if he's behind bars.
Right.
So in that sense, it seems absolutely absurd. And it's really unbelievable how often we do that. We will pick people who owe something. They owe victims. They owe the system. They have to pay in some way, and yet we lock them up, and they don't actually have the opportunity to return the money that they owe.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I can tell a quick anecdote
sure.
that kind of goes along these lines. I know a legislator in East Texas
who said that he had a small convenience store in his district, and somebody walked into the store and bounced a $400 check, which is theft, of course. That person essentially stole from the convenience store by doing that. So this this woman who had bounced this check, they found her. She was arrested. She was put in and out of the system. She had to have indigent counsel appointed for her because she obviously couldn't afford her own lawyer. I mean, it was just a really, really difficult situation for her. But, you know, she did bounce a check. So the legislator went to the convenience store owner and said, well, are you happy? This woman really got what was coming to her, right? And the convenience store owner actually said, you know, all I ever wanted was my $400 back. Mm. And nobody has given it to me.
Oh, no.
And I thought that that just beautifully shined a light on the whole problem. And in a sense, I think that your caller's story sounds analogous.
Yeah, what a dramatic story. Chris, thank you very much for your call. John in Janesville, hi.
How are you doing?
All right, John, how are you?
Not too bad.
All right.
I was wondering, they said that in Republican states where they have Republican governors, they have less crime and stuff. But Wisconsin has tons of prisons. Why didn't they do anything about all of those?
Well, there's a campaign to do that. We'll talk about it the second half hour, but it is different here in the state of Wisconsin. I don't know how familiar you are with our state, but maybe you can give us, in the states where governors are reluctant to do what Texas did, the reason for that would be what?
Well, yeah, I'm not entirely familiar with Wisconsin's politics, but I do know, as most Americans who follow politics know, that Wisconsin politics has been very exciting for the last several years. It's made a lot of national headlines.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense of it is that it's a hotly contested political culture these days. It's not as though the state is uniformly Democratic the way perhaps it once was. It's certainly not uniformly Republican just because there's a Republican governor. And many of the states that are mentioned in that Pew study, they lean very, very heavily red. Texas, for example, is a state with a Republican governor and a Republican Senate and a Republican House. We elect Supreme Court justices here, so it's also a Republican Supreme Court. You have a very strong political culture that was able to rally around certain core ideas, the ideas we were talking about, getting spending under control, the social conservative message of finding a way to improve families and neighborhoods. And we also mentioned the fact that in Texas we don't have the concerns about organized labor that you may have in other states such as Wisconsin. I think those are probably a big part of what's holding back reform in certain states.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was looking at a Mother Jones article about conservatives leading the way here, and it began with a story about Newt Gingrich, who unveiled as part of his new conservative agenda putting more Americans behind bars. He was speaking about violent offenders particularly, but then he came out in 2011 and said there's an urgent need to address the astronomical growth in the prison population. We can no longer afford business as usual. And he said conservatives must lead the way in fixing it. Can you foresee at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland down the road this being part of a platform, this being part of a presidential campaign, or not?
Well, as a matter of fact, it already is a part of the platform, and it happened at the previous Republican convention in 2012, the one that nominated Mitt Romney. They incorporated language into the new platform that focused on reentry for ex-offenders and making sure that we have a way to reintegrate these people into society. There was language in the platform on the issue of overcriminalization, the notion that we just turn too many things into crimes, things that ordinarily would have been punished historically as civil actions. There really was excellent language like that in the platform, and I fully expect that they would have it in the platform again in Cleveland. The one thing that we may not see is too much discussion at the presidential level, and that's not because I don't think the candidate would care. It's because the issue, by and large, is, or at least it should be, a state and local issue rather than a federal issue. Now, what you might find, and what I do hear a lot of on the right, is that you will hear people in a federal capacity, senators, representatives, you know, potential candidates for president, they will say that too many things have been criminalized at the federal level that ought to be handled at the state level. Antonin Scalia, for example, Justice Scalia, he testified a couple of years ago before Congress, and he said it really was a great mistake to take all of these drug crimes that had always been handled in the state system and have them absorbed into the federal system. And now the federal prisons are full of all of these drug offenders, which I think the states could have handled just fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of a messaging point, I think, which is sort of a 10th Amendment related, federalism related, return power to the states, that's a very important part of the criminal justice story. And I'm optimistic that you would hear a Republican presidential candidate talk about that.
Yeah. And Eric Holder last year, wasn't it, said that the Justice Department was no longer going to prosecute people who were convicted of minor drug offenses?
Yeah, that was an interesting moment. You know, I think you had, when Eric Holder made that announcement, I think there was a lot of sympathy for the ultimate goals of the president and the attorney general there, but probably less sympathy on the right for the methods. It seemed like that was the kind of thing that ought to be decided by Congress, not simply announced by the executive branch. Of course, reasonable people can disagree on that, but I think just about everybody is, you know, within the reform community, happy with what the results are intended to be. It's a process question, though, and the process question is serious.
Mm-hmm. And Vikram, what about your thoughts on treatment for people who have been convicted of and are in prison because of drug offenses? It seems to me as though the rate of recidivism would be very high unless you had some kind of treatment component.
Oh, sure. I think that's an absolutely essential part of it. You've got to have some kind of a treatment component for drug offenders, for domestic violence offenders. It's a very important part of it for people who get caught driving while intoxicated. There's an absolutely critical component of this that involves treatment.
So would you say that the tide has turned here, that there are enough governors, enough cost, when you look at the fact, which is really astounding, that the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world, that we are, as a society, going to be doing something different? We already are in some states, and it's just the beginning?
It's just the beginning. I think in some regards we've kind of we've plucked the easiest cases, the low-hanging fruit, you might say, and we're nowhere near finished yet. There are still, you know, a lot of very serious situations to be dealt with. We touched briefly on the federal case and some of these, the bursting federal prison population, particularly because the drug offenders there. We also talked earlier about California's situation. They did pass a tweak to their three strikes rule recently, but there's still much that can be done in California. Florida is another very large state that is ripe for significant prison reform. We haven't seen much in Florida. There's a whole component that involves juvenile justice that really greatly needs to be reformed in the United States. And a lot of these cases are yet to be tackled. So although we've had a good few years, I certainly hope that we don't get complacent. I think there's much more work to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're doing the work. There's no doubt about that. Vikrant Reddy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Vikrant Reddy is policy analyst, the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. This whole Right on Crime campaign began in the state of Texas. He's also worked as a research assistant at the Cato Institute and as a law clerk and an attorney in private practice, focusing on trial and appellate litigation. Moving our attention now to the state of Wisconsin, Reverend Willie Briscoe is joining us, president of MICA, based here in Milwaukee. Willie is an interesting man. He had a 25-year distinguished career in law enforcement and corrections. He retired as the deputy superintendent of the Milwaukee County House of Correction, so obviously he has a really knowledgeable understanding of what actually is going on in some prisons and who is in prison, where perhaps they may benefit by being in another kind of setting. MICA is joining Wisdom, which is a network of 160 faith-based communities across the state calling for, and it's the name of their campaign, Reform Now. They say that gravely ill and aging inmates are not being released in the Wisconsin prison system. There's a lack of accountability that has botched the parole system. And decades of overcrowding has put the staff at risk and cost taxpayers more than $1 billion a year. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Reverend Briscoe as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And Reverend Briscoe, thank you very much for being with us once again. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Are you in a speakerphone?
I am at the moment. I can go to a single one. Hold on.
Could you? Yeah. It'll sound a little better.
Yes.
There we go. Much right. better. Thank you. Let's jump right into the parole system. You're saying that the system has been botched. There's a lack of accountability that has botched the parole system. What do you mean by that?
Well, right now, under the current administration of government, there are no paroles. Individuals that would have been paroled under the old law are now being what you might say detained under the new truth and sentencing law that actually happened while they were in serving their regular sentence. So they were not grandfathered in. They were actually just now since adjudicated under the new parole system, which really is truth and sentencing. It does not apply to them.
And what was the old law? Tell me more about that. What's the old law?
Well, the old law was that you were giving a sentence and you were giving a minimum part of your sentence where if you actually completed that in programming and you had good behavior, you could be paroled early from a larger sentence. It dictated whether you had taken in programs to be able to reform yourself, and it took in account your change in your behavior or the adjustment period, and you were able to be paroled. Truth in Sentencing came out in 2000 and basically said that you're going to serve the length of whichever sentence that the judge imposes. There's no going to be no good time release and no early parole.
Mm-hmm. I know that you have highlighted a couple cases in your movement, Reform Now. Tell me about some of the people who are in prison right now and would have been eligible for parole under the old law but are still in prison and probably should be out.
Well, we have over 3,000 individuals who actually are in this, caught in this, what you might say, catch 22. It is individuals who every time when they come up for parole, they have taken the courses that were allotted to them. If they were able to get into them, their behavior has not indicated that they have resorted to their old ways. They have not committed any violent crimes. But the consensus that they're being told by parole boards is, you haven't served enough time.
So that's the standard answer. Sorry, you have not served enough time.
That's right.
So serving enough time means serving whatever the sentence was?
Well, actually, that has no definable answer to it. So are you saying we haven't served enough time to be rehabilitated, or you haven't said that we haven't served enough time to satisfy the public outcry, or if we haven't served enough time? It has no discernible or no definable answer to it, because when you look at the majority of these individuals, they are no longer proven to be a threat to society. They have fulfilled the time that with the minimal requirement that the courts had dictated. And to say that they have not served enough time is just a blanket answer that really makes no sense.
Why is it that we spent the first half hour speaking with a conservative who was highlighting Texas and highlighting Republican governors who have been at the forefront of prison reform? Why is it that we're hearing from them, and we heard from Vikrant Reddy the first half hour, that part of the philosophy is social conservatives believe in redemption and that should be a part of our prison philosophy? I would assume that you would say that that's not playing out in the state of Wisconsin. Why is it that we're different, do you think?
That is a good question. And I can't explain what this administration's goal is in this effort. I do know that the public has been led to believe that the length of people's sentences and the treatment that they receive while in prison has something to do with keeping the public safe. But when you have the majority of people going to prison, and that's the lion's share, not doing life sentences, they're going to be released in society. So it makes no sense to impose harsh and extended sentences on them, knowing that you need to release an individual into society that is basically with the tools and with all of the advantages to actually become a productive member of society. Mm-hmm. To continue to place punitive measures on them past their sentence, I really can't tell you what they're thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you'd like an answer from the governor. Wisdom is a network of a huge number, 160 faith-based communities across the state. You have asked to meet with Governor Walker about this, haven't you?
Many times.
And?
And we have not gotten that meeting as of yet.
Do you get a reason why not?
We don't get any answers. We just basically get rejections.
You have such an interesting background for this issue, Reverend Briscoe, because of your work as Deputy Superintendent of the Milwaukee County House of Correction. So you worked with inmates all the time and saw the prison population. I don't want to put you on the spot here, and maybe you can't answer this, but I'm wondering, looking at that population and then looking at the whole population, would you say that we have thousands and thousands of prisoners who would be better served by going to a rehabilitation program or have already done their time and would be fine in society? Do we have thousands in prison who shouldn't be in prison, do you think?
Yes, we do. And we have thousands who could have used some type of diversionary program that would have basically steered their life in a different direction. There are some things that we've known in corrections for the amount of years we've done it in this country. We've known that putting minor criminals in with hardened criminals usually create hardened criminals. They don't have the reverse effect. We've known for years that if you don't start rehabilitation the first day that individual ends up in prison, you have a chance of causing mental illness by some of the punitive methods and putting them in isolation. We have all known that we have just been warehousing individuals and not basically using any kind of system to steer those individuals through restorative justice by just warehousing them away and thinking that the sentence is going to teach them a lesson and that they were going to come back out in society as full and productive human beings.
Mm-hmm.
We've known this, and I've seen it personally, and I've seen so many talented and so many gifted individuals who just needed someone to steer them in the right direction because they couldn't get out of their own way. And I want to go on the other hand and tell you, yes, prisons are necessary. You're going to hear that from some people who are going to call in and say, but it's not necessary for everyone, and it's not necessary for the lion's share of the people that are there.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Reverend Willie Briscoe, who is our guest this hour on this part of the program. He is the president of MICA in Milwaukee. He also had a long career in law enforcement, deputy superintendent of the Milwaukee County House of Corrections. There's now a movement among many in the faith-based community, 160 organizations across the state calling for reform now, and you've heard Willie outline what the reform is that they're calling for. What do you think? 800-486-8655. What do you think about what he said about the parole system and the people who are locked into were sentenced under an old law and are now locked into a new law so that they really aren't eligible for parole, if the whole phrase of good behavior seems to be kind of meaningless in this new system? Is there a better way? 800-486-8655 is our number. You can always use our email, too, which is talk@WPR.org, or the Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, phone lines are filled. Let us go to Jim in Milwaukee for the first caller for you, Willie. Hi, Jim.
Hi, my name is John.
Oh, John. Hi, John. I'm sorry.
That's fine. I happen to know an inmate who's been in and out of jail since he was 16 years old. He's 30 years old. He comes home and he has no friends. His only friends are the reason he went to jail. The only thing he has is whatever he does before he went into jail every time. There's nobody here for him. His family isn't enough. And if they're drug addicts, 90% of them, well, they return back to drugs because there is nothing for them. In Milwaukee, the job rates are so low that getting a job is selling drugs. And I mean, I know one personally, and he's a very good friend of mine. And no matter what we do to help him, it turns up to the same thing every time, that there's nothing to do unless I work and hand him money all day long to put a roof over his head and food in his mouth and clothes on his back.
Mm. Reverend Briscoe.
And there you have the crux of not only the problem with our incarcerated, the problem with those who will be future incarcerated, is that the lack of opportunity and intervention is what contributes to the recidivism and crime in the first place. We have to detach that anvil that is attached to individuals who go into prison. They come out, they have a stigma of a prison record that keeps them from getting employment. They have a stigma of this that keeps them from living in certain neighborhoods. And then we tell them, okay, dust yourself off and pick yourself up and start all over again. Well, that's hard to do when you have these strikes against you. We have got to provide jobs, and we've got to provide intervention in order to heal this problem, or else it is going to be a huge financial and a physical drain on human capital.
Well, I imagine we're already experiencing quite a financial drain. You cite the amount of money that we're putting into prisons compared with the UW system, and more money's going to prisons, right?
And people are willing to pay that money, those who aren't informed. Now, you're going to hear people tell us that, what about the victim? Well, when you live in the inner city and when you are familiar with this, you're the only one person removed from a perpetrator and one person removed from the victim. They are both our relatives. They are both our neighbors. And there has to be a way that we have to be able to heal both and make sure that both become contributors to society. If we neglect one, we're just going to create more of the other.
John, thanks for your call. Ruth in Madison, hi.
Hi. I have two things to say here. Another important consideration is that the women's prison, Tichita, in Wisconsin, at the beginning of this administration had about 500 women there. There are now more than 800 women there. One whole building is women who can no longer even feed themselves. And I don't know what's the point of us paying to incarcerate people. I understand the men have a whole prison that's filled with people who, inmates who are still serving sentences but can't even feed themselves. But the other thing I wanted to say about the demoralizing effect about the parole situation is that when you ask for parole, you almost never get it. They'll give you like 48 more months, and so you come back in 4 years and apply again, and they give you 18 months, and then you come back again after your year and a half, and you're expecting 10 months or 12 months. And then you get sent to the minimum security and trained and released. But what happened when the administration changed this time is that women who were expecting 10 months or 12 months were given 48 months again. And so the question was, what's the point? What was my good behavior all about? I got 4 more years before I can even apply again.
Yeah, Reverend Briscoe.
And that you have is that standard answer, you haven't served enough time. It's beginning to be a catch-all. And I don't think the average public knows how frustrating and how demoralizing that is to some individual who have dedicated their time to turning their life around and to getting a second chance. And when you keep penalizing them and keep putting them in this situation, that is a situation that causes mental illness and stress that leads to recidivism when these people do get out.
Thank you, Ruth, for your call. Paul sends an email. Is there any real strategic and consistent policy in the middle of this apparent train wreck? Is there any leadership that is not simply short-term and self-serving?
And right now, and I like the analyst, his ending speech when he ended his session by saying that there is change coming, but it's not coming fast enough. Mm. Each and every day that we still are under this system and have people being perishing in jail into this vast abyss, we stand the chance of losing one more individual who out here on the street who have not entered that system yet. So we have not gotten to that sensible legislation and the legislators that have decided that this is a sense of emergency and that we need to do something about it now.
Tim, driving a truck in Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, I live in Iowa, and used to be John Deere Waterloo, who was recently ranked the 34th worst city to live in the United States, and it's mainly because of drugs. People have no jobs. We had a Republican governor come in there, Jerry Branstad, and in his talk to the state about wanting to be governor again, he said he was going to bring jobs in. Well, he never has. His son was drunk two separate times, took the lives of four Iowans, being drunk, vehicular homicide, and the kid never spends a day in jail. Well, that's understandable. You know, it's the governor's son. But why put him in the state house of Iowa to be the director for Iowans for tax relief, and the people of Iowa pay him $100,000 a year? I do truck, and they say that truckers are the most informed Americans as long as they listen from coast to coast. I'm out in Washington State, and they just passed a law out there that everybody that comes out of the penal system still has to go to the parole and probation officer, but they took the main ingredient with marijuana, THC, out of the drug testing and have had minimal return convicts going back to prison. So that just kind of lets you know whatever the government has been telling us for so long isn't exactly the truth.
All right. Thank you very much, Tim, for your call. What's happening with nonviolent drug offenders in the state of Wisconsin now, Reverend Briscoe?
We have in the last few years come up with drug courts and drug diversion. And one thing that MICA and our state affiliate Wisdom has been lobbying for is to get more money diverted from the detention to this prevention measures of eliminating these individuals with minor drug cases populating our prison. What he just mentioned was common sense legislation that has to take place that will actually give people a chance to either heal themselves or be recovered through diversionary tactics other than putting them in jail and creating another barrier for them to become productive citizens.
One more call. We're running out of time. Alex in Delafield. Hi.
Hi. I'm actually a product of the Wisconsin prison system, and like the Reverend has said, it is human warehousing. But along the same topic line as you were just discussing, the majority of the people that I encountered were a result of a revocation because of drug offenses or alcohol offenses. Not necessarily a new crime, but they were on probation or parole under the old law, and they were revoked because of a substance abuse issue. And the issue that I have is that there was one, I was in a prison that the population was somewhere around 2,100 people in Oshkosh, and there was one program for alcohol and drugs, and the majority of people didn't have the opportunity to take that program because it was so booked and backlogged.
Oh, really? So we need more programs like that. On that note, we'll have to say goodbye. Reverend Willie Briscoe, thank you very much. Let us know when you make progress and having the administration listen to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Reverend Willie Briscoe, president of MICA in Milwaukee. He also was deputy superintendent of the Milwaukee County House of Correction. He worked with law enforcement and corrections for 25 years. Now joining Wisdom, faith-based communities across the state calling for reform now in Wisconsin's prison system. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production. Thanks for listening. Another hour coming up here on the Ideas Network.